Great, so that's 1 Samuel chapter 24, and that's page 296. Begin at verse 1. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. He came to the sheepfolds along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner from Saul's robe. Afterwards, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." With these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. Then David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, "My lord and the king." When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say, 'David is bent on harming you'? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord gave you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lay my hand on the Lord, because he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I am guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me. And may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, 'From evildoers come evil deeds.' So my hand will not touch you. Against whom is the king of Israel come out? Who are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand." When the Lord finished saying this, Saul asked, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And he wept aloud, "You are more righteous than I." He said, "You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. You have just now told me about the good you did to me. But the Lord gave me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. I know that you will surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear to me by the Lord that you will not kill off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." So David gave his oath to Saul. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold.
Great, thank you very much, Tom. Please keep your Bibles open at that page, and we'll have the title up on the screen, "When Others Treat You Badly." Are there people who treat you badly? Maybe an old friend who just dropped you. Maybe an ex who cheated on you. Maybe a family member who fell out with you. Someone at work. Someone at college, someone who was rude or harsh, an example that was unfair, a company that wouldn't give you a refund. You think about it and it bugs you, it irritates you. I wonder if there are people that you don't want to bump into. If you see them on the street as you walk along, you're really hoping they don't notice you and talk to you because it's awkward now and there's tension. Or you wouldn't want to take a call from them. And how do you react when people treat you badly? I guess some people lash out and get angry, and you can hear that anger in their voice. Maybe they're trying to control it, but you can still tell. Some people are more sort of passive, aggressive, and just state things in a very simple, dry, cold way, or have a polite little laugh when they actually don't find it funny at all. Perhaps the best retaliation of all in these situations is complete silence. You ghost someone, you blank them, you give them the cold shoulder, you completely shut them out of your thoughts and your life. The trouble is, however we get back at someone else, the chances are that will make them feel more negative about us. And if they were treating us badly before, they'll treat us even worse now. And the whole thing becomes a bit of a cycle. In fact, sometimes so much so that when there's tension between two people, it can spread even to the whole family. Whole families fall out with each other. It can go on for generations. Sometimes even whole communities. Think of the hostility at the moment between people who would describe themselves as conservative or progressive in the United States. We're seeing that on our TVs at the moment, aren't we, in the debates that are happening there, the kind of coastal cities in the States with younger people who take one view of life, and then those who live more in the center of the United States who take an almost opposite view of life and who think very badly of one another. Or think about the Northern Ireland conflict, which is back in the news, going on long before any of us were born, I think, and still continuing to be a difficult area today. The Cold War between East and West, the whole world really divided almost in two, erupting occasionally in a conflict of the kind we've just seen recently, with no end of suffering for those caught up in it, and the rest of us affected in all kinds of ways, especially those who struggle financially. Jesus has a different way. Jesus has a better way of dealing with the situation when others treat you badly. In fact, it's right at the center of who he is and what he's about. And his way transforms people's hearts and lives and can even change whole cultures and change the course of history. He is a king who suffers for those who treat him badly. It's the main thing to know about Jesus. He's a king who suffers for those who treat him badly. He dies to save them. Well, Jesus made that point and sort of summed up this whole part of the Bible that we've just been reading from, that we've been thinking about for the last few Sundays. He summed it all up in a few words. You may have heard me point this out before. Jesus said, "Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" That's from Luke 24. And Jesus, I think, referring mainly to the story of David in 1 Samuel, where David suffers all sorts of things, so that in 2 Samuel he can then enter his glory. And we're going to look at what we can learn about Jesus and about ourselves when others treat us badly by looking at these stories of David. When others treat you badly, firstly, Christ treats enemies well. That's my summary of chapter 24. We're actually looking at three chapters because they're very, very similar theme across all three. So we're just going to touch on each of them to show you that. Christ treats enemies well. That's chapter 24. Even those who hate Jesus are treated with generosity and gentleness that they don't deserve. So chapter 24, let's look at verse 2. It was on page 296 in the Church Bibles. Verse 2, "So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats." Saul is convinced that David is after him, that David is dangerous, that David is a threat to his throne and his future, so he is hunting David to kill David. But Saul has been doing this for so long, he needs a quick comfort break. He needs to quickly go to the toilet. He sees a cave and just takes a moment to go inside the cave and use it as a toilet. But while his back is turned, little does he know that he just so happens to have chosen the very cave that David is hiding in. A bit further back in the shadows, there is David with some of his men. And they see Saul coming in, and they whisper, the others whisper to David, "This is your chance. You can catch your enemy with his pants down." Literally, he's on his own. He's defenseless. He's helpless. He'll never suspect it. He's got his back turned. And David doesn't answer them. He just quietly creeps up behind Saul in the dark. And he lifts up his sword, and he brings it down, and he cuts off, well, nothing much, really, just a tiny little bit of Saul's travelling coat, just really to show that he could have killed Saul but didn't. He was that close. And he takes that little bit of coat back and he tells the others off and he says that is not what we're going to do. And once Saul is kind of all buttoned up and leaving the cave and has gone a safe distance, at that point David comes out and calls from a safe distance and shouts out to say what has happened. Chapter 24, verse 11. This is David speaking to Saul, verse 11. See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I am guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me. May the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. You see what he's saying there? May the Lord judge. It's not my job, David says, to be judge of you. I can leave that to God. He's much better at it, and he'll take care of it. And if God wants you to pay for your crimes, if I'm right in thinking that I am the one who is wronged here and that you've done wrong, well, then surely God will. I can leave it to him. Well, Saul looks down at his traveling coat and sees that, sure enough, there's a bit missing. And there is David standing over there holding the bit that is missing in his hand. And he suddenly realizes that he's had a narrow escape, that he nearly died. And just for a brief moment, his mind clears. And he's able to see the truth. And he realizes that he's been wrong about David all along. And through his tears, he says this, verse 17. You are more righteous than I, he said. You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. You have just now told me about the good you did to me. The Lord gave me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. You see what Saul is saying? You treated me well, but I treated you badly. And Saul says, well, that just never happens. That's just not how the world works. And he's right about that, isn't he? You treat someone badly, they treat you badly back. And then you treat them even more badly. That's how the world works, but not how the Christ works. That is not how the Christ comes into his kingdom and gains his power. It's not how it was in the Old Testament, and it's not how it is in the New Testament. When Jesus was arrested, his friends wanted to fight, but Jesus said no. He said, look, I can send an army of angels anytime I like and demolish the whole lot of you, but I'm not doing that. I am choosing to die. Jesus choosing to die for the friends who betray him, choosing to die for the enemies who insult him, choosing to die for the indifferent who crucify him, crying out, Father, forgive them. And that is really good news for me, and really good news for you, because you and I are people who treat Jesus badly. Aren't we? We don't want to live his way, and even if we do want to live his way, we don't always manage to live his way. We don't really like the idea of him being in charge and not letting us do or say the things we would like to do and say all that we're tempted to do and say. And so we give him a hard time and we shut him out. And he watches us and he sees our lives. And there must be things that he sees in our lives day by day and week by week where we are treating him badly. And yet he chooses to treat us well. To die for us. To die for us, his enemies. And make us his friends. To love us and save us and forgive us and change us and help us. Christ treats enemies well. And then secondly, Christ doesn't return insults. That's the next chapter, chapter 25. He doesn't retaliate or get his own back. Chapter 25, verse 4. While David was in the wilderness, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. David is still in the wilderness. He's still out in hiding. He doesn't trust that Saul is really a changed character. And while he's out hiding in the wilderness, he and his men help out some local shepherds. They protect the flock from wild animals. And when the time comes for these sheep to be taken and sheared and for the wool to be sold to make a profit, well, they've never had such a good year. All because David and his men have been protecting the sheep. So David sends a polite request to the owner of the sheep, to a man called Nabal, who is celebrating and partying with all of the people who are shearing the sheep. And David says, look, do you think you could spare just a little bit of your food and drink for us? There's not a lot of food out here in the wilderness. Well, it's not much to ask. And the sheep owner, Nabal, he's a really, really rich man. He has thousands of goats and sheep. He can easily afford to do this, but he's also a very difficult and rude man. And he sends a message back, why should I give my hard-earned bread and water to some runaway slave that escaped from the king? You're a nobody to me, David. David gets the message and he loses his temper. Maybe he's been in hiding for too long, running for too long. Maybe the hunger of living in the wilderness is starting to get the better of him, but the red mist comes down over his eyes and he is furious and he says to his friends, look, bring your swords. Let's go, loads of us, and let's teach that Nabal a lesson. But happily for David, Nabal has a wife called Abigail, and she is nothing like her husband at all. Where he is rude and foolish, she is wise and sensible. And here's how she reacts to the situation. Chapter 25, verse 14. One of the servants told Abigail, Nabal's wife, David sent messengers from the wilderness to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not ill-treat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Night and day they were a wall around us, the whole time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. Abigail doesn't waste a moment. She gathers the food that David asked for and plenty more besides. She gives him the best of everything. She loads it all up on some donkeys and sends it with some servants ahead of her. I don't know if this is thought through on her part. It's been said that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. But I guess sending the food first and the gifts first may just help him to calm down a little and hear what she has to say. But she is a brave woman. She goes up against him on her own with no defense and no swords, and she speaks to him in a very plain way. She knows her husband is, well, an idiot, but she also knows that David is not doing the right thing. Chapter 25, it's over the page. Let's look at what she says down in verse 30. Chapter 25, verse 30. When the Lord has fulfilled for my Lord, this is Abigail speaking to David and calling him, well, she knows that he's going to be the king. He's God's chosen king. She's calling him my Lord. When the Lord God has fulfilled for my Lord David every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him ruler over Israel, my Lord will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord your God has brought my Lord success, remember your servant. She is tactful, she is gentle, she is careful, she's respectful, but she's also very, very direct and plain speaking. She says, look, when you're king of God's kingdom, you don't want the staggering burden of needless bloodshed on your conscience. Well, David knows good advice when he hears it. Verse 32, David said to Abigail, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. When a stranger tells you off, when a woman corrects a man, when someone speaks truth to power, it's a blessing, it's a gift. And David sees that. You're sent by God, he said, just at the right moment, just at the right time, just to say the right thing to me. I thank the Lord for your good judgment, for keeping me from doing a terrible thing today. And of course, as it turns out, Abigail was proven right, probably more quickly than anyone would have said. Abigail makes the point, look, you don't need to get revenge on Nabal. Everybody answers to God and God will take care of it. And sure enough, no sooner has Abigail gone back to tell the whole story to Nabal, well, she can't at first because he's too drunk. But the very next day he has a heart attack and 10 days later he's dead. And when David hears that Abigail is no longer married to this cruel and foolish man, that she's a free woman, David asks her to marry him. And she says yes. After all, what more could anyone want from a wife or a husband than someone who will stand up to them and tell them what they need to hear and teach them to be more like Jesus? We all need that, don't we? We all need help to be more like Jesus. And that is the role that David is stepping into. He is becoming the Christ, and he needs to learn to be like Jesus in the way that he does it. The New Testament says this to us, 1 Peter, to this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Are you and I learning to be like Jesus? Are we learning to follow in the footsteps of Jesus? To be insulted without insulting back? To be mistreated without retaliating? There are two things we're going to need that will help us. One is we need people in our lives who are like Abigail. If you're at the stage of life where you're looking for a partner or open to that possibility, choose someone like Abigail, someone with the courage to challenge you, someone who will tell you what you need to hear, not just what you want to hear, and someone who will help you to be more like Jesus. Someone maybe with the wisdom and the tact to know how to go about it. What will it take? Maybe some nice food and a gift to calm you down first. If I go home tonight and find Catherine is cooking me a nice meal, I'll know that I'm in trouble and that she's got something to tell me and to sort me out on. But one of the great blessings of marriage is that you do have someone who spends enough time with you to be able to see where you're going wrong and help point that out to you. And those of us who are single will need to find people who will do that for us. We need to find friends who will help us with that and encourage them to be honest and give them permission to tell us when we need help. That's the first thing we need. We need someone like Abigail. And the second thing that we need is we need to believe that God judges and punishes sin. Now that's surprising, isn't it? You wouldn't expect that. Mostly we tend to think, well, if someone believes that God is a God of justice, that he judges and punishes sin, that he's a sort of vengeful God, well, people like that will surely be nasty. But the point that is made again and again in these chapters is if you don't have a vengeful God, you have vengeful people. If God is not going to put everything right at the end, if you don't believe that there's any justice in the world, then how are you going to deal with that anger and frustration against those who treat you badly? But when you realize that everybody dies, that everybody meets God, that everybody answers to him and faces him, and that he never makes any mistakes with justice, that he's perfectly fair, well, when that's in your heart and in your thoughts, instead of feeling angry with them, you might actually feel compassion towards them for the way they've treated you and pray for mercy. Christ then treats enemies well. Christ doesn't return insults, chapter 25. And then finally, Christ keeps treating enemies well, chapter 25. If the headings all seem very similar, it's because the chapters are all really making a very similar point. So let's pick it up in chapter 26, verse 2. The top of the next page, page 299. So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 select Israelite troops to search there for David. Saul has already forgotten his tears and his nice words about David, and once again he is hunting David and trying to kill him. In fact, if you read chapter 26, I know we didn't have time to read it all, but if you do read it later, the main thing you're going to notice is how similar it is to chapter 24, which we did read. The same things just keep happening again and again. Even the little details of the chapter are deliberately similar. Once again, Saul is searching for David. Once again, David gets a chance to retaliate. He gets a kind of free kick at the goal. Once again, David's friends want him to kill Saul. Once again, David says no. Once again, David keeps something to prove that he has not taken his opportunity to kill Saul, a little memento. Well, Saul and his army this time are camping at night, and they're all fast asleep, and David just happens to get a good look at them and see where Saul is sleeping, surrounded by others who are also sleeping. Chapter 26, verse 7. So David and Abishai, is one of David's friends, David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. And Abner and the soldiers, Abner's Saul's kind of right-hand man, his general, Abner and the soldiers were lying round him. Abishai said to David, "Today God has given your enemy into your hands. Now let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of the spear. I won't strike him twice. I'll kill him in one go. One clean shot. Let's do it." But David said, verse 9, to Abishai, David said, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him, or his time will come and he'll die, or he'll go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and water jug that are near his head, and let's go." It's the same logic as before. Why do the wrong thing? Why take it into your own hands when God has got it all in control and he's going to bring the right outcome at the end? God has promised the kingdom to David, so there's nothing to be gained by going about it in the wrong way. David goes a safe distance. He's got the spear that has often been thrown at him, and he's got it to prove that he could have killed Saul very easily. He shouts and wakes them up and tells them what happened from a distance. And once again, Saul realizes he was wrong. Verse 21, "Then Saul said, 'I have sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you considered my life precious today. I will not try to harm you again. Surely I have acted like a fool and have been terribly wrong.' 'Here is the king's spear,' David answered. 'Let one of your young men come over and get it. The Lord rewards everyone for their righteousness and faithfulness.'" The whole thing's a repeat. It's actually been going on since chapter 18. Again and again, Saul sees his mistake. Again and again, he goes back to his old ways. But David is becoming the kind of Christ who doesn't just treat his enemies with kindness once, but keeps on doing that again and again and again. And what a wonderful thing that we have a Christ who is like that, who keeps on showing mercy to us again and again and again. Because if you're anything like me, you know there is that moment when you turn to Christ the first time and you're aware of your sinfulness and you bring it to him and you admit it and you receive mercy and forgiveness, and it's a wonderful relief. I can still remember how I felt to know that all of that was washed away and dealt with. But it turns out that that is not the end of it, and that years later, decades later, you're still coming to church Sunday by Sunday and asking again to be forgiven. It's why we often have a confession in our services. And we have a Christ who does not get impatient with that. How often we let him down, how often we fall short, he doesn't run out of mercy. And he teaches us to be like that too. Someone said to Jesus, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to 7 times? Jesus answered, "I tell you, not 7 times, but 77 times. Just keep forgiving them till you've lost count." So let me ask you again, are there people you don't want to see in the street? Kind of feel a bit awkward, would rather cross over. If they rang you, You'd hesitate before answering their call. I wonder if there are people that need our forgiveness, that we need to be kind to and patient with, and keep offering that mercy to. And I wonder if we need to keep coming back to Jesus for ourselves and trust that he does forgive, that he does help, that he is making us more like Jesus, but he is patient, however long that takes.